which was, you know, fascinating at the time. There are several people after David Bowie died who said that he saved their career. The Mott the Hoople guys said basically they were going to break up. You may have even told me this.
Lee Erickson's here.
And they said Mott the Hoople was going to break up because they hadn't had any success. And he was like, well, let me record one of your songs. And so he recorded All the Young Dudes.
Yeah.
And they got a huge royalty check out of it. And then Peter Frampton said, in so many words, that he saved his career. At the time of, like around 1990, Peter Frampton, who still to this day inexplicably recorded a double live album that was the biggest selling live album in history.
Yeah.
Frampton Comes Alive, surprising everyone, including his record label.
Yeah, that made me want to ask, is it a good thing that his career was saved, or is that too mean a thing to say?
Oh, you can say that if you okay. want. How's your career?
Well, not at Peter Frampton's level, so my hat's off to you, Mr. Frampton. That's
yeah,
cool.
So like, so Bowie, so he was a big enough star, like he was in that difficult probably place where you're sort of you're famous enough to be well known, but not famous enough to maybe be, you know, like getting any better or making a living or really getting anybody to sort of want you to do anything, maybe.
Right.
And so David Bowie went on tour and you know, for some reason, his lead guitar player was Peter Frampton, which was strange enough because Peter Frampton was a great guitar player. But you know, it's sort of weird when two famous people. When yeah. somebody like recruits another famous person to be there, but it's not like a double header. Yeah. It wasn't like David Bowie and Peter Frampton on tour. It was right. like Peter Frampton was in the band, and then he sang the lead, the harmony vocals on like literally like one or two songs.
I have the Isle of Wight concert by Leonard Cohen from 1973. If you haven't checked,
I'll
that
bet
out,
you do.
You should definitely check that out. And I'm watching the DVD. And he's doing one of my favorite songs. And who steps up to play fiddle? This big dude. I'm like, that guy looks familiar. And it's a young Charlie Daniels, of all people, playing with Leonard Cohen at the Isle of Wight in 1973. Like, Charlie Daniels, like, Devil Went Down to Georgia, Charlie Daniels.
Well, yeah, you know, it's because people have to find their niche or whatever. So, like, I mean, it is weird. That it seems strange, right? Because you think of Charlie Daniels as being right. Devil Went Down to Georgia, which, you know, for better or for worse, was later him finding his niche. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, like, Waylon Jennings and Buddy Holly played in a band together.
Yeah, yeah, I just can't see Leonard Cohen saying, the South arise again, you know, well, maybe his Canadian accent.
I mean, Charlie Daniels wasn't saying that then.
That's
saying,
true.
He was saying, you'll pay me to play fiddle? Hell yeah.
I think he's wearing overalls and the big hat. I mean, I don't think that became an act later. He really looked like Charlie Daniels, but just really young and with Leonard Cohen's band.
Charlie Daniels looking exactly like Charlie Daniels.
Yes, exactly.
Good morning. This is Trivial Thursdays on WRFL. It's about 15 after 7 in the morning. I am your friendly neighborhood radio host, Mick Jeffries, and I'm here with Leif Erickson, who has deigned to join us once again.
I'm not Danish. I'd like to make that known. I have no problem with the Danes. I'm not Danish, but I did Dane.
Okay. Do you have any friends named Dane?
No, but I like Miller's Crossing, and there's a really great character in there named the Dane.
He probably gets shot, though, right?
Oh, yeah. He's a villain. He's a really bad villain. I love okay. him.
Let's see. So, good morning to those of you who... We were just discussing the matter of the rain outside and the walking in the rain. Yeah. I discovered an incredible thing this morning. It was in our house, and I'd seen it before, but I'd never used it, or I wasn't sure what it was. From what I understand, it's called an umbrella.
A bumper chute. Right.
I used it. I left the house with this thing, and I used it, and I walked here. I have to say, it just for anyone that's ever been curious or maybe a little bit afraid of them, they work. It worked. It totally worked.
Like, did you have a sword in yours that you can pull out if there's danger about?
There's a sword in there?
Oh, they all come equipped with that, Mick. You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that, but I'll keep that in mind next time I encounter fill in the blank.
I've started to develop sort of an irrational anger at rain. I think it's since I started walking.
You have a lot of
ago,
irrational angers, actually.
They usually manifest.
I think it's from your suppressed childhood.
Yes. Well, I didn't. It's not much suppressed. That's the problem. This is bubbling up like a La Brea tar pit. But no, I think since I started walking to work, it's just the idea of just getting wet on the way to work, even if you have an umbrella sometimes, and you can't look at your phone unless you have it in a Ziploc bag. We're back with the cavemen.
See, our positions are reversed here now because it's so new to me that I'm like, this is incredible. I'm dry under this umbrella, except for my shoes. And yeah, and I'm like, holy cow, what a revelation. I can't believe this is happening to me.
So what a great new invention this
is. So aside from, you know, doing a sort of pass around fellow pedestrian where I decided to walk through the, you know, kind of like the rain-drenched gutter. That was kind of my bad call. just to do that kind of American thing of not having to sort of have an awkward interaction of someone who just is also walking on right. the sidewalk. I'm like, no, but it's always sort of masked as politeness. This is something that gets me. That probably gets you too. Where like you use politeness as uh-huh. like an excuse to like not talk to somebody. Basically, right. you're like, oh, excuse
it's
me,
like, let
me
get out of your way.
I'll walk 10 feet out of your way just so you can. But really, it's just because you don't want to talk to somebody.
And you have to make that decision about when to make eye contact and if you should and do you nod? Do you say good morning? Do you say how are you? Which is really an empty question. They're not going to answer that. It really is awkward.
They do, then, you know. I mean, I answer that question, and then, like, I don't know. It gets awkward after that, right?
You just carry around cards and hand them out with your current state on them. That's what you could do, really. Save yourself some time.
Yeah.
Well, you'd have to prepare the cards.
See, I know. It's always it's a lost leader, once again. Well, we've got a great show today, and in just a minute, we'll play a song or two, and then we're going to visit with Jessica Moeller of the Carnegie Center, which is always wonderful. And then later in the show, I'm delighted for Donald Mason to be coming around. I don't think Donald's been on the show since he's been the director of the Lyric Theater, but I'm a huge fan of the Lyric Theater, which is on the rise for sure. So that's in the second hour of the show. And Leif Erickson along to confuse, taunt, and distract my guests as we go along.
Giddy up.
So, right now, here's something from the Beatles. We'll be back. Prince there with 7 from Musicology, I think. I don't know. Yeah, Prince had like 39 albums.
Yeah, how are you supposed to keep up?
I'm not exaggerating. I don't learn that from news articles. I had no idea. Like, if I were to guess, I would say maybe 20 records. He had like 39 records. 7, the track there. That goes out to Lori Houlihan, who, like so many things, I wouldn't have heard X, Y, or Z, except that Lori was like, you have to hear this. That's a song she tried to get March Madness to do the chant to.
Yeah, I think that's still in the works, maybe. I mean, I've heard her bring it up to Tripp again recently.
We've tried it. Yeah, no, she is dogged, too, so that's
yes.
good.
keep at it, Lori. Keep at it. It's a good song.
Jessica Moeller's here. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Haven't seen you in a little while.
I know.
How's life?
It's going well.
Yeah.
It's really good. Baby, he's great.
Yeah.
Prince was his first show. 2 months old in my belly.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
Yeah.
Excuse me, that a little bit. There we go. So, yeah, Silas.
Silas,
little
yes.
Silas. Now, and then, so do we talk about this before, whether Silas is named after Silas or not?
He's definitely inspired by okay. Silas House.
I thought maybe Silas Marner.
No. Silas, a lot of people have asked that too. Silas Clay, Silas was reading at the Carnegie Center, and I texted Daniel. We could not decide on a boy's name. And I just texted him Silas, and he texted back, yes. Well, that was it.
What was how critical was the time frame at that point? Or was it?
No, we were still pretty.
So we still hadn't decided on a name after daughter had been born.
Oh.
For real.
Yeah, no, we decided.
And then we had to because someone posted, someone who shall remain nameless, who is beloved by all of us, I don't know what you say. Someone else posted a photo of our newborn daughter on Facebook before we did.
Scooped you.
On
your own kids.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because, you know, I've been like sending photos to like a few people through text and someone else put it on Facebook, and then we were like, we have to pick a name. Now we have to pick a name because there's a photo of the spawn online now.
Welcome to Internet 2.0, right?
Yeah.
Social media, yeah.
Yeah, we went over Facebook guidelines before Silas was
born. Yeah, well, you know, those guidelines may need to be expanded. I don't know if you guys saw the article. I saw an article not too long ago that basically said that there's kind of an unfolding as sort of time goes on and social media has been around for a while now, there's there's sort of growing evidence that your kid might be kind of upset after a few years when there's a bunch of pictures of them online, mm-hmm. when they get to that sensitive age, and they're like, why did you put all those photos of me on the internet? My friends can see baby pictures of me, and it's embarrassing.
Yeah, Daniel was kind of cautious about that from the beginning. He just thought it was an invasion of his privacy, and we don't have his permission, and maybe we should hold off.
So that seems to possibly, he might be a forerunner.
We found
in that.
A happy medium, one picture a month.
Oh, wow.
That's good for the relatives out of town, maybe your friends,
it is.
You know,
I love
things
sharing
like that.
It, especially with people out of town. So
there's no privacy anymore
and
at all.
And I think
unless you just tap out of the whole thing, you know, or.
Yeah.
Then you could have some privacy, but then you don't get the internet. So it's kind of like one of those things.
The internet does work for some things. So
it does.
It's hard to like not have it. For instance, the Trivial Thursdays, which is on Facebook, you know.
I've heard of
the Facebook group. Sometimes people post things to the Facebook group, especially when my social media manager, Nicole, is around, but she's been out because of the family situation for a while. And then I used to do it. I don't know. There's some things you ever get worse at, like not better. It went early on when I had the Facebook Trivial Thursdays page and the Twitter account. I used to update the Twitter account, update the Facebook page, and interview my guest. And I just thought I was being fantastic at it.
But you weren't?
Well, let's just say I stopped updating the Facebook and Twitter things so that I could talk to my guests.
Oh, well, that's nice. The guests appreciate that.
Yeah.
So somehow I suspect that the latter version is a better service to most people. And then
I'm sorry.
And then every now and then I throw up, you know, some sort of.
You know, I thought you throw up. I was like, well, every now and then that will happen to people, yes. I have a Twitter account, but I think maybe I'm too old. Because I'm not drawn to it. I try every social media that comes out. I sign up for it and try it at first. I tried Periscope, Yik Yak, which is the most nonsensical, stupid thing I've ever experienced in my life. But I try them all, but most of them don't grab me. I think it does have to do with age, maybe.
And what Twitter, about Yo? Did you ever try Yo? Yo, here's what Yo does. All Yo does is, Yo is a social network thing that a former RFL general manager Ainsley Wagner, and she went to California and works in the big internet biz, and she got me to do Yo for a while. And all Yo does is you have your friends, your social media friends, and it will send you, click a button and it sends them the word Yo.
Like poking them, basically.
That's it.
And by the way, Yo does, that phrase sounds like somebody you're trying to explain patiently to someone that they're more than one Yoda. Yo does. Yo, nothing, crickets. I thought it sounded like that, but I have had caffeine.
Well, we definitely use Facebook and Twitter at Carnegie Center. I mean,
For sure. It helps you guys.
It does. It's an awesome platform. The changes ever so often always take adapting to. You know, it seems like every several months there's some new restriction that just messes everything up.
Restriction in terms of?
Like when the fan pages, when they change that algorithm. And if you post something, it just doesn't have as high of a prominence if you have a personal page. So we had to switch from a personal page to a fan page. We were kind of forced out because we weren't.
Wait, that hasn't happened to me yet, but it's going to real soon.
It still hasn't happened to you?
Mm-mm. I think it's a money
group. I have a group rather than a page.
Okay. So we had a fan page and or a friend page. And we had, you know, over 6,000 friends and awesome, you know, communication and had a really high frequency of posts and being seen and all that stuff. And then one day I got an email that was, you're not a person and you can't have this Facebook account anymore. Mm. We had 6,000 friends. It was devastating.
There's like a business model there, someone to, or at least a part-time job, but translates into a business model for someone who's just like, I will go and notify every single one of your friends individually to go like this page.
Well, I ended up finding I was able to merge the accounts. Somebody gave me a code that I was able to like type in to like find the loophole of Facebook.
Nice.
And I was able to merge like most of the accounts. But
a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah. But the fan page still doesn't have like the functionality as great as the friend page.
That's good, yeah.
So there's some,
that's
because
they want to sell you stuff.
Because they want to and they want you to buy ads, which we have.
Yeah,
you know, we do sponsor
thing.
Posts, mm-hmm. and I will say they've been, you know, they've been effective for us. And a $30 post can bring us just as much attention as 500-page ad. So
it's like the crack deal where they gave you the free exposure for a long time. Hey, you like that? All you got to do now is buy an ad. You can get the same thing we were giving you for free. Come on in.
Now, you guys, the Carnegie Center has always, and you guys are on Facebook and maybe Twitter too. I don't know.
Yeah, right? I tweet and Facebook every day.
Which is probably, I mean, it's more time than one would guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to craft the messages differently, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening at the Carnegie Center, so I'm at least once a day. It's more like three or four times a day.
And you guys do a lot of stuff on your website, too.
We do. Yeah.
And there's not always necessarily overlap, because one can absolutely exhaust oneself, like, updating all these different media. Like, I know your, like, Books in Progress thing, which is coming up, right?
Yeah, next Thursday through Saturday, 2nd through the 4th.
Right. Like, I noticed that's on your website, but and you mention it on, like, Facebook, but
yeah,
there's not necessarily an event for it.
Or right, we didn't make
I'm not trying to call you out for that, by the way.
No.
I'm going to make the event, I swear.
No, there are some things we'll make events for and some things we don't. Just because if I found that a sponsored ad tends to have a further reach than doing an event.
Okay.
Because the other thing with the fan page is you can't invite all your fans. So you have to, I'd have to take my personal account, invite my personal friends. Then I would ask Neil, the director, to invite his friends and then all the staff members. And that's a lot to ask people to do. Mm-hmm. So the event page is great, but as a fan page, you can't invite people to the event. Really stinks. So we've been focusing more on these sponsored ads on Facebook and definitely on the website. I mean, if you we have a pretty high, you know, if you Google writing in Lexington or even writing in Kentucky, Carnegie Center is typically a top hit. So we have a good online presence.
So how do you what are the things you've got coming up that are things that you're sort of tooting the horn of? We talk every now and then. For the last several years, you come in and talk about Books in Progress, which is a great way for writers who, if I may paraphrase, and you can correct me, and that
Please.
Can be our conversation, for writers who are having trouble, I don't know, getting on the stick or working out the details. People who have an idea for a book, like you hear people say, everyone's got a book in them,
right?
And, you know, I don't know.
Well,
I know
I'm glad
that
you touched base on the idea, because a book in progress can be the, you know, the final stages of your manuscript. It could be your 50th revision, your 100th rejection, you know, or it could be just this idea for a book that you've been having. I was on WUKY with Gwen Rubio.
I'm sorry, you can't say WUKY on the station.
I'm sorry.
Don't you have a dump button? You can jump out of that.
Just kidding. We love, there are sibling stations.
Yes, but I was on the radio with Gwen Rubio the other day, and we were just talking about this, you know, how an idea starts. And she just finished a book that's getting some attention, where she writes from the perspective of a cockatoo who falls in love with his caregiver. And anyway, she said this idea had started 15 years ago. She was in Australia, and she had seen this beautiful woman with long hair and even longer legs. And when she turned around, there was a cockatoo on her bike. And that, like, put the thought of the book in her head. So the Books in Progress Conference, you know, facilitates even just the smallest idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an array of workshops that cover everything from craft to the business side. So, you know, how to get published, which is really important. The Carnegie Center wants to teach people to write, but we also want them to make money. We want to support our artists, and that's a really important part of our mission. So we have an opportunity for folks to meet one-on-one with literary agents. These two are coming in from New York, and it's a, you know, you get a six-minute pitch of your book, which is really hard to get in this world.
Okay.
So
you mean to land one?
To land one, yeah.
And to craft one.
Probably. And to craft one. But we had several last year who I think maybe 20 or so that actually requested full manuscripts, which is a pretty big deal. So year after year, the literary agents that come through are incredibly impressed by Kentucky writers. And I think we're able to secure such you know, top-notch literary agents because Kentucky is this hotbed. And then,
well, and pause for just a second there.
Yeah.
Kentucky is this hotbed, this
a
literary hotbed. And I don't know if everybody, lots of people may not quite get that. I think I've mentioned to you before one time when I went to a reception party for Nikki Finney, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and I felt like I was just like surrounded by. I was, in fact, surrounded by the Kentucky literati, and I felt like really kind of humbled and awed by it. So, I mean, you guys are just right in the thick of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's this wonderful community that I feel that we've all been gifted with. And the Carnegie Center kind of serves as a safe haven for writers. And I think that's one of the things that makes the Kentucky writing community so strong is that not just that there's a place where people can congregate, but Kentucky writers really take care of each other. Mm-hmm. If you go to, if it's Holler Poets or an Appalachian Poet Reading or the Kentucky Great Writer Series, you always see literary folk in the audience. I mean, they mm-hmm. really do come out and support each other.
Mm-hmm. And you could be starstruck if you're me and walk around and see Ed McClanahan walking around or, you know, Nikki Finney when she was around here. Uh-huh. I tell my students, you know, she won the National Book Award, which is like the Oscars, only meaningful.
Right.
You know, people like Walker Percy won the National Book Award, Faulkner, I think. I mean, that's huge company, and she's from right here in Lexington. It blows my mind.
And she wrote Rice, which wasn't the National Book Award winner, but definitely one of the books that got her, you know, on that stage in the Carnegie Center. One of our cubbies, we named a cubby after her.
Is that right?
Because we feel like it's been blessed with, you know,
no doubt.
Nikki luck, Nikki, and it's not luck. She's everything she has, she's worked at. But mm-hmm. you know, this like the gift of Nikki. Maybe you'll
and a great person.
Well, and
too.
This is
she is.
Well, I mean, it's hard work. I mean, that's
kind of
and you
work.
Guys, what you guys kind of help people. Process is how to I think anyone that most anyone you know who tries to write knows that it's hard work, but lots and lots of people, and I'd count myself among them, I just almost kind of throw up their hands really and just they're like, I don't know, I'll work on it tomorrow.
Well, writing's an art, and I think that it's hard for a lot of people because, you know, writing's also a necessity. Writing and reading are things we have to do in this world to get by. And so to put the time into something that's a necessity, I think people can get stuck there, you know. But when you put time into writing and you start crafting it, that's when it becomes an art. Mm-hmm. And so it's such a remarkable process to see that writer come in and go through revision after revision after revision, and then a rejection, and then a revision after revision after revision, and then, you know, walk away with their life's work.
Mm-hmm. And writing is a way of liberation. That's what I try to teach my students. So
I think
it's
that's
like
very true.
Yeah, and you can do that through writing.
It should be noted that when Leaf is not being a smartass, he is a writing teacher. Although probably you're that too, even.
I think they do mix well together. I'm just not mean with it, you know, because you got to be nice to your students. That's a good thing.
I'm sorry, you're saying.
I just writing. Yeah, so whether you're writing for a practical purpose, because I like this in the classroom, because I can teach them. When you're in a class where the teacher is really academic and strict, you tailor to that audience. And that's a way of liberation. If you want to write to express yourself about your childhood or your ideas or just a novel you have in you, that's a way. All that work you're talking about, the revision, the failing, the trying again, that's all learning about life and how to live the best life and mm-hmm. Being liberated, being free. I think language is all tied up in that, definitely.
I agree. So, yes, come to the Carnegie Center next weekend. I think we only have 10 spots left for this mm-hmm. conference. So one of the reasons why the Books in Progress conference, I think, you know, continues to thrive each year is because it is a much smaller conference. So you have more of this individualized kind of tailoring to each student's needs. But we kick off on Thursday with the pre-conference retreat, and that's with A.J. Verdell, who is a revision queen, and she will be able to get you in really good shape. But you can spend the day with her, and then the official conference kicks off on Friday, and Wendell Berry is our keynote speaker. So we are just delighted to have him back at the Carnegie Center.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a long history with you guys, right? Or not?
You know, he doesn't have, I wouldn't say a long history. I feel like our relationship with him, he's had a long history with Kentucky authors. And so I think that kind of automatically gives him a relationship with the Carnegie Center. But he hadn't been, I guess, you know, I felt like a part of us actively until the Writers Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And he was our first living author who was inducted into the fame.
Was this
or
last
into
year?
The hall. It was in 2015, because mm-hmm. Bobby Ann Mason was this year, 2016. So he was our first living author. And I think he just came into the center and felt the energy of writers past and present, and realized that there was something really special going on. And so we quickly invited him back for this year's conference, and he graciously accepted.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So we're just really stoked. It's, you know, a lot of people don't have the opportunity to learn from Wendell as a writer. He hasn't taught in many years. Mm-hmm. He focuses.
So he did taught at UK for many years, I believe.
Did,
right.
Right. But it's been I think close to maybe 15, 20 years.
I think you're right.
So for, you know. He hasn't been in the teaching scene, I guess, for a right. while. So it's a really great opportunity to learn from one of Kentucky's greatest, certainly most prolific living writer. And
someone who is, you know, I think that sometimes, again, being kind of close to the, you know, being from the same place that Wendell Berry is, roughly from here in Kentucky, it's mm-hmm. a lot of people may not know that he is internationally celebrated. And a man so far ahead of his time, so far ahead of his time.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
In his thinking, where agriculture and society are concerned. I mean, just a living philosopher.
He really is. I mean, it's we have an event following the conference that we're calling Lunch with a Legend, and that's our mm-hmm. annual fundraiser. And Wendell's speaking at that as well. And he really is a legend. And I just, you know, encourage people. It's like, you know, we were just listening to Prince, so he's on my mind. But it's, you know, did you miss Prince when you had the opportunity? You know, mm-hmm. don't miss Wendell. Like, mm-hmm. he's somebody whose words stay with you forever. Mm-hmm. And it's just that you don't want to miss the chance. So I would definitely say go to the Carnegie Center website, carnegiecenterlux.org, and get tickets. If you're a writer to the conference, it's 2 days, or to the luncheon.
I'll tell you what, let's take a break and come back and chat a little bit more with Jessica Moeller of the Carnegie Center, and we'll hear some more about what's going on at one of Lexington's premier places to become a better writer. Anna Meredith there. From the Varmints album with the track Taken. I love that album. It's insanely over the top. Maybe that's why they call the form of music maximalism. She's kind of she's like a modern classical composer who orchestrates insane pieces of music for large orchestras. Anyway, her record Varmints is astonishing. So I highly recommend it.
I hadn't heard of that.
I haven't either, except for her. Yeah. So yeah, like I said, that's Taken, which also has a really fascinating video that I would recommend too, which is also maximalist in its own way. It gives you a sense of maybe what maximalism is, which I can't really, I have trouble explaining. Sort of everything in the kitchen sink all at the same time. I don't know. I'm back with my guest marauder, Leif Erickson, who's here.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Jessica Moeller from the Carnegie Center.
Hello.
And we're talking about
writing.
Kentucky's literary world and writing. And
we were talking about discipline in writing earlier. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, that is one of the workaday aspects of writing that doesn't get all the glamour. And I find that I get defiant and lazy. It's a bad mix. Sometimes it's like, I don't understand. And I'm saying this, maybe there are writers out there who need to hear this, that it's like, sometimes it's just defiance. You know, I've got all these ideas. I want to write, but I just refuse to. It's a strange, the psychology is a strange thing.
I think you do have to carve out that time, like exercise, or like you were saying, walking, and you just really have to make room for it. When Nikki
said, make it a part of your life, kind of
priority.
You have to integrate it as just like a part of a daily routine. Nikki Finney had said, this is a couple years ago, I think when she was at the Books in Progress conference, somebody had asked her, when do you write? Like, when's your favorite time to write? And it's early morning. She wakes up like every morning at 4 and that's when her alarm goes off and she sits and she writes and with the sun rising. That was like her morning routine.
And you have to write even when you're writing bad stuff, even when it feels like every word is torture and you think I should do anything but write ever again. You got to do it for like 2 hours or whatever you set aside. Write bad writing if that's what it takes.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, I want it to be brilliant straight out of the block. Sorry.
It never comes out that way.
Well, that's the trick of the great stuff that you've ever read, right? Would be that you have to have faith that theirs didn't come out that way either. That Jitterbug Perfume by Tom Robbins didn't come out perfectly.
Not a first draft.
Yeah, probably not a first draft.
Well, you know, Flannery O'Connor, one of the most brilliant writers of all time. And by the way, they're showing Wise Blood as part of the Harry Dean Stanton Fest. And Brad Dourif is going to be here to answer questions. And I'm nerding out over this big time. But, you know, Flannery O'Connor, her stories seem so simple.
Is Wise Blood based on a Flannery O'Connor?
A book, yeah. Okay, it's brilliant. Checking. Her first novel. And okay. If you haven't read it, oh my, I can't even. I'll
clearly
talking.
I haven't
so good but you know she said that she some of her stuff some of her stories like A Good Man Is Hard to Find was like the 25th draft or something. I mean she slaved over those things, worked over them, beat herself to death over them, you know, to get them right, and whatever it took. Mm-hmm. That's what she did, but it wasn't a single draft. And I love telling my students that because we read one of her stories and it just seems so easy to understand and so well put together, and to know that she struggled to get to that point is a good thing to teach them, I think. This, yeah. My students do think it's supposed to come out as an artifact, complete, and it's a really hard thing to get them to not think.
Well, it's funny because I've talked about this with Bree Lowry and when we talk about ballet and Kentucky Ballet Theater, but there's almost this intrinsic flaw in great works of art, whether they're movement or words or whatever, where it's not really a flaw, but like what you get is seems perfect, and it's hard to see the work that went into it. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is like the fact that it's hard to see the work that goes into something is something that the modern age can address really well. Yeah. By showing, you know, like all the kinds of process work that you mm-hmm. can see now in terms of, I don't know, whether it's videos mm-hmm. or people's blogs or a books in progress kind of conference like you have sure. at the Carnegie Center. But I guess it's important for people to understand, and by people I mean me, that an unbelievable amount of hard work goes into things that if they're worked on hard enough and diligently enough, come across as natural. I will say this as a photographer, it's absolutely true. You know, I sort of hone the things that I share as a photographer and what went into them, the waiting, the considering and all that never gets seen really.
Right. Yeah. I think all great works, require, time and craft, you know, mm-hmm. you have to, you just don't learn to be a master of anything overnight.
That I've been trying that my whole life.
10,000 hours, I think is what they say it takes to be expert level at something. That's okay. A lot of hours.
That is a lot of hours.
But it's over, to get back to kind of the Carnegie Center and so the services that you guys kind of offer, it is overwhelming to think about that kind of thing. But you guys, I think, on a certain level, make it approachable. You're like, no, wait, just, you know, let us help you take baby steps and move towards this thing that you're trying to achieve.
Definitely, because that, you know, part of our mission is we want your voice to be heard. You know, we empower people to explore and express their voices, and so getting those words on paper means a lot to us. It validates the work that we do, mm-hmm. and so, you know, LEAF's actually a part of our mentoring program, which pairs people who are working on a book, a manuscript, with an author that kind of coaches them through it. And so we set up these kind of interviews with one of our mentors and a possible student and see if it's a fit. And it begins, this weekly mentorship. And that mentor makes sure that the writer is staying on track and that they're getting, you know, a certain amount of words in, and they're helping them with the revision process. So it's a really cool, another really cool program that we do at the Carnegie Center to mm-hmm. help hold writers accountable, right. and make it approachable. inaccessible.
I like what Mick was saying, you know, about it being whatever level you are at. I've formed that sentence badly as a writer, but whatever level you're at in your writing, you all are very encouraging and invite you to come be where you are in your writing. It's a really beautiful thing for a community writer.
Because there's readers and writers at every level,
sure.
And we need to acknowledge that spectrum, you know.
Yeah.
So the Books in Progress conference also does that, where we say, you know, come to the center, let's get your book published during this conference, meet with published authors, editor of Writer's Digest, meet with literary agents, pitch your book. You know, we have all these opportunities to make sure our folks are getting published, and that's whether or not it's just this tiny idea in your head or you're on the last pages of your manuscript. Wherever you are as a writer, the Books in Progress conference will benefit from it.
And your facilities are great, too. That was my library when I was a kid. I grew up here.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that space. You know, I say it often, but there's so much energy in that room. The feeling of writers is palpable. Once you come in there as a writer, I don't think you can ever really wash yourself of it. And it's like this addiction. Like, you keep coming back. You want to be around it.
Yeah.
You want to read in the same place.
Those are just the flashbacks from your old Hunter S. Thompson celebration.
Leading up to Hunter S. Thompson.
I walk in there and just have all these, like, these, you know, overlapping way you have excuse me, the way you have, I have those memories of reading there and kind of losing myself in the stacks and the mystery section and all this stuff, but now it's other things. It's a really cool experience to go.
Well, and that touches on this idea that we have at the Carnegie Center, where we complete the cycle of literacy. So at the foundation, our programs for our youth and family, this K-12, are teaching, you know, the basics of reading and writing. At the peak of literacy is when you're able to turn writing into an art form. And so we have kids who are just learning how to write and how to structure sentences and string them together. And they're in the same presence of National Book Award winners and Wendell Berry and Crystal Wilkinson and Bianca Spriggs and, you know, Silas House, who's also going to be with us at the conference next weekend, and Fenton Johnson. And these are all people who are accessible to the kids, too. So the cycle of literacy is really complete at the Carnegie Center. And you don't I would argue that there's probably not any other place like it.
I never seen you argue. I've never seen you argue.
and it's not a hole in the ground. You know, somebody didn't tear it down to, quote, develop something.
And it could have been, you know, it's Lexington. So it was very likely that it could have become a parking lot.
No, it's more likely that it could have become lawyers' offices.
Or lawyers' offices, right? And they tried to, actually.
That's what happens with most classical buildings.
Scotty Bassler, the mayor at the time, really fought for the Carnegie Center to keep it as a public space. When it became the center, the public center that it is today that we know, it had, you know, mold growing up the side and raccoons, and it had just been completely pretty much abandoned and just neglected. There was a great call for people in the community to keep it as a community learning center in this public space.
Yeah.
And thank goodness, because so many of those libraries have been torn down.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that many left.
That's
one that used to be on UK's campus was torn down.
And these are, did you, I had my headphones on cue for a second.
Oh,
did
sure.
Did you tell the kind of cool thing of the Carnegie libraries? Did you mention that? You've told it before.
No, I didn't.
Because it's interesting, I think. The creation of the Carnegie libraries.
Yeah, so the Carnegie libraries were by Andrew Carnegie. This was after he raped everybody on the railroads, and he's trying to make, you know, a legacy. We'll go ahead and
he's trying
that.
To get into heaven.
People are complicated.
I better do something good. And he did. He did a great thing. And he went to cities all over the country and built public libraries, which at the time didn't exist. So you had to pay for a library to go to a library. Women couldn't often go to libraries. Black people couldn't go to libraries. So, I mean, there was a library at that point was really considered
something rich people had.
Yeah, it was. And everybody else was kind of
you're like,
exposed.
You should get one. It's great.
Right. And so Andrew Carnegie came in and said, I think everybody should have access to reading. Everybody should have access to books, and it should be free. And so this was really the start of public libraries. And thank goodness for that we still have it, and that the Carnegie Center has like tried to hone in on that spirit that initially created the building and keep it going as a learning center.
Yeah, so the Carnegie that building Wait, was it there?
It was the they built it. It was the original public library.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in around the 80s, Lexington population outgrew the space, mm-hmm. and they realized they needed a bigger one and built the wonderful one downtown. Of course, now we have about six branches. Is that right? Uh-huh. Yeah, it was
89 was when they built the new library. The new one library. Downtown on Main Street, that was 89.
That was 89. And then the Carnegie Center, as we know it today, was 92.
92, yeah.
So it said a couple years, you know, empty and abandoned, discussions of lawyer offices or condos or a parking lot. But thankfully, the architecture was preserved because the space is so important to the work we do. I don't think the Carnegie Center could exist without that building.
And I mean, to say nothing of the grounds around it. I mean, it sits in the little Gratz Park.
Yeah,
and the most,
it's gorgeous.
You know, if you were bringing like visitors to Lexington, I always try to make at least a loop around Gratz Park just for its, you know, sort of just absolutely antebellum quality.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you can see old pictures of, you can see Morrison Hall in the old Morrison in the background in the park. It's just great to look at those old pictures and still see the park there. Like you said, in Lexington, it's not a parking lot. You know, it's not a shopping center that's abandoned.
We don't have a lot of green spaces downtown.
No.
Gosh, is that like our only one?
It's
really kind of.
Triangle Park has some.
Yeah.
Well, you guys. So things kick off. Things kick off for the Books in Progress thing. When is that?
The Books in Progress conference starts on Friday the 3rd. So this is next Friday at 8 a.m. But we also are offering a pre-conference treat with A.J. Verdell, who is coming back for the fifth year, because time and time again, every year after their conference, everyone says the highlight was A.J. Verdell.
Oh, okay.
She is just... she's a revision master, and this is what she teaches is, you know, revision. So we're excited to have her back again for a full day for the pre-conference retreat, and then she'll also be in a few breakout sessions. And then we'll have Jessica Strasser. She's the editor of Writer's Digest. So this is a wonderful person to have in the building for publishing connections and kind of the business side of writing.
Okay.
And that also plays into what we've done a couple years called our Conference Idol. And the idea was originally fashioned after... American Idol.
Right, which I didn't get that when you first mentioned it, but now I do.
Right. So
I thought it was the person people love the most, but it's actually kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, so it's an opportunity for writers.
It sounds like it's kind of like the Gong Show, actually, for my era.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
If you participate in the conference, you can submit 250 words. It's anonymous. We'll have a panel of publishers and writers. Your work will be read, and you're basically your job. The three will raise their hand if they when they want the person to stop reading if they don't like it. Sometimes it goes all the way through. It can be, you know, hard, I think, for people who have never had that revision process, but it is so incredibly beneficial. And even if it's not your work, just to hear what they say about others. Like, I sit in on Idol every year because it's so fascinating what these published authors and agents and publishers are saying about other people's work. You learn so much what they're looking for. It's pretty cool.
People can still, there's still space, right?
Yeah, not much, but I think we have 10 spots left.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So grab them while you can.
So people can check that out, like, I guess, your website or on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah, you can go on Facebook or CarnegieCenterLex.org. I would go to the website. We have our agenda on there, so you can see what the breakout sessions will be and pretty much how the whole workshop or the whole conference is laid out. And it's in 1.5, you know, intense days of workshops and crafting, and of course Wendell Berry is our keynote speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely going to be a great opportunity to hear and learn from a legend.
Now the Wendell Berry luncheon thing, that's got to be all like that. That's all packed up, isn't it?
It's pretty full. I think we do have spots left.
Is that right? Okay.
We do. We grew it a little bit this year to accommodate a larger crowd. So it'll be in Gratz Park under a tent.
We'll have cool.
It'll be a farm to table lunch. So you'll get to have a really nice meal while you listen to a legend. It's going to be really lovely. And all the proceeds benefit the Carnegie Center. So you can write that off at the end of the year on your taxes.
Okay. Jessica Moeller, thank you so much. It's always great to see you.
Yeah, thanks
always
for having me.
Always come back
Nick.
And visit. I think I asked you this before, but is there anything, what are you going to come back and talk about? What's on the horizon for the Carnegie Center?
Let's see. The next big event is probably Carnegie Classics in November.
Oh, you're not ready to unveil that yet, are you?
I could tell you.
Really?
This is the first public announcement.
Oh, thank you.
But we're doing 1984. It's our first dystopian novel. It's 3 days before the election.
Wow.
And we're really excited about it. It's darker than we normally go. And I think in that sense, going to be a little bit more challenging to throw a party around. But the Pearls got down. They had lots of excess. So we'll have room, one room filled with excess at least. But no, I think it's going to be a really powerful night. And coinciding with the election, of course, this is a bipartisan event, but it's just the timing, just it seemed to fit.
Now, is there any, I feel like in the past you've done things that, and maybe I'm wrong, but that had kind of a Kentucky connection. Is there one for George Orwell's 1984?
No, and actually Fear and Loathing was our first classic that was by a Kentucky author.
Okay.
So we've done To Kill a Mockingbird was our inaugural year.
Right.
And then we did Catcher in the Rye, okay, Great Gatsby, Hunter, Fear and Loathing, and then this year we're doing 1984.
Right.
And it's also our first European writer, now that I'm thinking about it.
I think I didn't really realize that George Orwell was...
He's British, European. I believe.
Okay. Yeah, he is.
George Orwell, and I always feel like George Orwell and Aldous Huxley are just like, they're just spinning in their graves at like warp speed. And they're also, like, I always imagine those guys, like, coming to the first kernel of their ideas for, like, Brave New World in 1984 and, like, having this moment of clarity where you're like, oh, man. Oh, no. because they're so, God, they're both so on the money in a variety of ways. And that must have been a little depressing to have that vision.
The only thing Orwell missed is that he didn't envision that it would be possible to make people want to follow and want to partake of the oppression. He thought it would be he said it was a boot on the face of man forever, something like that, but it's not. It's people just signing up for their own, to be controlled, you know. But his name was Eric Blair, by the way. He was British. He died at 46 years old of tuberculosis. I believe it was tuberculosis, but he's 46.
You mean George Orwell?
Yeah.
Okay.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he died pretty young. He did all that work. And I don't know if you've read his essays, but oh my God, he's brilliant, brilliant. Essays, a lot of them, and all before he was 46.
Well, I'm super excited to
Thank you for announcing that on the radio show.
The 1984, I believe Carnegie, it's November 5th.
Carnegie Classics this year.
On Saturday. Always a great party. No matter what the book is. Just a way to...
Everyone wear your bleakest clothes.
You can come in blue overalls or black overalls.
That's it.
Jessica, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming and visiting. This is Trivial Thursdays. We're going to take a little break here and come back. So, and more there. From the album More Rain... A pick from Donald Mason here. Well done, Donald. I guess. I can't tell down here in the bunker. Apparently it's still raining.
Yeah, there's some cats and dogs out there.
All right. I'm planning to walk home, so that's pretty exciting for me. Donald, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Donald, you're the director of the Lyric Theater, is that right?
I am.
That makes me very happy. It probably makes you kind of happy.
Hopefully. I like making other people happy.
You're also an RFL alum and contemporary, I believe.
Yes, and actually, today is Miles Davis's birthday, and this Sunday from 8 to 10 will be a special Miles Davis tribute show.
Are you plugging your show on my show?
No. Of course I wouldn't do that. I will say...
No, on Sunday you do the...
Moved back to Sundays. It was on Tuesdays from 6 to 8. Uh-huh. For those who... Our longtime listeners, it was the old Jazz Vault slot that, it seems natural for jazz to be a little bit more of a chill time in the evenings. I got some mixed reviews when it was 6 to 8 during the week, like, I'm not ready to chill yet. Like, but you should be because you just got off work. That was my.
I'm not ready to chill yet.
Not ready to chill yet. Hmm. That literally was a complaint that I got.
Well, Miles Davis can fix that.
Miles Davis fixes most things, still, even beyond this planet.
So today's Miles' birthday. We've got to play something. I'm thinking something off Sketches of Spain, but I'm also open to a myriad of other choices.
You know, Kind of Blue would probably be, you know, something, especially with the conditions outside. Hopefully y'all are staying safe out there.
Now, you brought a friend along. Tim Small is here.
Yes. Hey, Tim.
Hi there.
Hi, Tim.
How's it going?
Thanks for coming and visiting the show.
Sure thing. Appreciate you having me.
You guys, so let's see. I didn't want to leave Tim just sitting out in the cold, although I'd do that to my guests, but we don't know each other well enough for me to do that to you yet. Next time, I'll just leave you sitting out in the cold for a while.
I appreciate that.
So, Donald, you're in the I think, seemingly enviable position of marrying your fondness for jazz with some of your work life too, and the venerable history of the Lyric Theater, which for those who don't know, we should touch on that because the Lyric is a miracle kind of.
So earlier with the Carnegie Center, it was mentioned that you know, the Carnegie Center sat dark for a little while. Well, the Lyric sat dark for almost 50 years,
falling in on itself.
Yeah, and
literally.
And it's surprising that, you know, it's a blessing now that they didn't raise it for a parking lot or something like that. But honestly, they probably should have, just based on...
We're supposed to keep that a secret, okay?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, so 48 was opened. It was a premier African-American theater during the segregation period. You had people like Count Basie and Cab Calloway and Ike and Tina Turner, so many, Dinah Washington... And even people that we don't have a direct link to for, you know, to be able to honestly say they played there. But probably anybody you can imagine during that time played at the Lyric. Also playing movies and playing, you know, different things. We have evolved since we reopened. 1963, it closed. The community kind of stopped supporting it because you could go other places.
Mm-hmm.
It took a big concerted effort by some council members and... some mayor administrations to really move it forward. 2010, cut the ribbon, and we just celebrated our 5-year anniversary last year, and doing great things. We're really pushing.
This is what we're talking about in the East End,
yes.
At Third
and Elm Tree,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is Rose Extended to those on campus.
And it's, when. It's funny you said that about they probably should have torn it down. It was in, like, as someone that lives a block away and watched it getting rebuilt and always supported it getting rebuilt, you could, if you were cruising by very often, you saw that in a lot of ways what rebuilt meant was kind of being taken apart completely and then sort of put back together.
Right.
And then added on to in the most spectacular of ways.
Yes.
It's probably twice the square footage that it was before, maybe more.
I would say more. Now, the theater space is a little bit smaller. It used to seat 800 or so. Now we seat a little over 500. But we also have the Wee Street Community Room that pays respect for the street that we were parallel to, but also gives the community an opportunity to rent a space, have events there. That was something that wasn't happening before. And then upstairs, we have the museum and gallery. So we can be, you know, we want to be so many things. And one of those things is an arts and cultural center that people can really find either themselves or learn something about, as well as just a place that we can celebrate our history and celebrate the community of people using our building.
And build on that legacy, that incredible legacy of, like, some of those people that you said have performed there.
Right. And that's part of it. You know, we just had Galactic. We are going to announce, this will be a soft announce here, as Talib Kweli is coming in September.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm so excited about that.
And those
Talib
are,
Kweli?
Yeah.
That's
he's coming.
Great.
So, you know, shows like that are important, but we also have, and Tim can talk a little bit more about our film series, which is going into its 5th year.
Yeah.
That also pays homage to the history of what the Lyric was about. And then new programming, such as the youth summer youth programming, which is just fantastic. We want to be able to be that place. I mean, we want, if you talk about the Lyric, it's hopefully it has a positive impact on your life.
Yeah. So. Well, leading into Tim Smalls here, who is involved in the programming of the film series. You know, when the lyric reopened, I think I've told you this, Donald, maybe the last time you were on the air, but I remember when during the reopening festivities, I remember hearing an older neighborhood guy who claimed that he was sitting in the seat that he always sat in when he was a kid to come see the movies. Now, the accuracy of that is probably not, but basically here's a guy who had this legacy and he was sitting as close as he could sit to where he sat when he was growing up. And that's the kind of legacy that the lyric has, I think.
Yeah, there's so many community members, generations of community members. And, you know, you think about that missing generation of mm-hmm. the generation that didn't get to see it or was, you know, a kid right when it closed and you had to live your whole life without it. So now it's being built. So, you know, we're still working to make sure that the community is aware and open to what we have going on. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly trying to find, you know, things. This series has, you know, influenced by the community, and they wanted some more contemporary films. We were adding some contemporary films, and also a, you know, repeat of something that has been before. So,
mm-hmm. Tim, how long have you been involved in? How did you get into programming? I don't know, like film series.
I don't know about film series themselves, but I started in the nonprofit world actually with Jessica, who was with you before this over at the mm-hmm. Carnegie Center, and then started at the Lyric about 3 years ago, and that's when I started with the film series there. Mm-hmm. So, I
mean, what's the kind of like operating principle behind this film series, I guess?
I mean, it's much as the Lyric's mission, it's to celebrate African Americans in film, whether it be musicians, producers, actors, directors. So mm-hmm. we just kind of try to take a good spread of, from the start of film to now, you know, how African Americans have made great achievements and great strides in the world of film, which I think is something that's underrepresented, not necessarily in the films that are made, but having a group of them together.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you go about... How do you go about collecting or sort of curating such a thing? Where do you start, or how do you winnow it down?
Well, we have input from our board of directors, who usually give us suggestions on what we want. We take the staff's recommendations, and then we go out to the public. In the last couple of years, we've kind of had just like a Q&A during the movies of what would you like to see, what do you feel like should be shown, how could we be doing it better, because I don't know, much as the Lyric is constantly evolving with our programming, we're trying to constantly evolve with the wishes of the public.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it does have an incredible, you know, I think, I don't know why, with the Lyric in particular, maybe because it's surrounded by residential neighborhood. I always think that the Lyric has a history and also kind of a responsibility to be just really community driven. So, well, I don't know if that's perceived correctly or not, but it just seems like it sits right in the middle of, you know, a residential neighborhoods.
That's always been one of my favorite things when, you know, we have to do our surveys as nonprofits do about how did you hear about the program, and a ton of people say it's from the Marquee, which is funny for us because, you know, of all the marketing strategies we use, but it really is in the end, the people in our neighborhood walking by see it up on the Marquee, see it on a poster, and come to the program, which is a really unique and really cool aspect of it.
It's pretty hard not to look at that marquee if you happen to be walking by. But you're right, that does seem like a feather in the neighborhood cap there.
And our, you know, like Tim said, the poster cases. So, you know, we aren't 100% movie theater, but when we do have shows and, you know, movies, right now you can go up to our wall and see the whole list of movies. And it's just, you know, people walk by, people sit there. We also have a scrolling marquee inside the box office to not protrude too much on history, but we're making our, you know, modern day history. So we have a double marquee, which is 24 hours scrolling, so people that are just sitting at the stoplight can see what we have going on. And it's hard, as most people know in marketing, who is getting what source and who's paying attention to what. One of our main tenets is just high level quality programming. So if you get experience at the Lyric, most, you know, I would say 99.9% of the time, you're going to be leaving with a positive experience, which then you're going to tell somebody about. and then we'll see both of you the next time.
Right. So, Tim, do you want to talk a little bit about what you guys, what's going on with the series, or maybe even like hit on some of the, just to like build suspense, maybe hit on some of the, so what were some of the high points of last year's series? Did you have any unexpected smash hits or even just, I don't know, what was attendance like in general for the series last year?
It was good attendance. I mean, it's a really consistent group of people that come down there and are always really excited for the movie-going experience. And a lot of those are like the generation who came to the Lyric when it was originally open, so it's always cool to have them coming back into it. But it's always consistently, last year it was Imitation of Life, the 1939 version, which it's so funny. People watch that movie and it's like, what movie would you like to see next year? And they're like, Imitation of Life. Like, they just love that film every time that we play it.
But, see, that's a great opportunity for education right there, because I'm completely ignorant of that film.
That's a really great movie. Well, you'll get to check it out this year, fortunately. Uh-huh. But
and what are the, so what are some of the hallmarks of that movie that you think makes it resonate so much with
well, I mean, it's intercultural conflict. You know, it's an African-American woman growing up with a white family and her struggle with self-image, which is a huge theme across African-American Zen film and thematically to common day.
Okay.
So it was really resonating when it came out, and they made two remakes of it, one in the 50s and I think one in the 70s. So obviously it didn't lose its poignancy over time.
Mm-hmm.
So that one was really good. But a couple years ago we had you've seen Bruce Lee Enter the Dragon.
Okay. Oh, right.
Jim Kelly, the African-American actor from that movie with the huge afro, is actually from Lexington.
That's right. I remember when you guys were kind of repping this years ago.
So, yeah, we played that and Black Belt Jones, and, like, the people from his old karate school got to come out and show support. And his ex-wife, Marilyn Dishman, is one of our volunteers who has been from the start. So there's all these awesome interconnections for us and for him. So that was one of my favorite times with the film series. That was a special experience.
And maybe kind of a, I don't know, to the casual observer, maybe an unlikely choice.
Oh, yeah.
Until you sort of look more closely.
Oh, yeah, especially comparing like something thematically like Imitation of Life to something like, you know, Black Belt Jones, which is a blaxploitation karate film. But, so it jumps around, but I mean, the reasoning is always there.
Yeah. Are there any blaxploitation karate films this year?
No. Unfortunately.
We got to wait till next year. Or it's the after.
Are you going to have an entire festival? So what's, I'll tell you what, why don't we take a little break here, you guys, and play some Miles. And today's Miles Davis's birthday. And so in deference to Miles and to Ron Penn, who taught me everything I know about jazz, and to the Smithsonian history of jazz, like 5 record set, I'm going to play So What on a Blue. If you want to celebrate Miles Davis's birthday, you can just listen to just about anything, but you can't do much better than Kind of Blue, 1958, right?
Yep. Blue and Green is probably my all-time favorite song.
Yeah.
It just like is every time I listen to it, it just fits the mood.
Right. Let's see. Donald Mason is here from the Lyric Theater, and Tim Small also. And thanks you guys for being here. Let's talk a little bit more about what the Lyric's got going on. The film series is coming up. When does that start?
So it starts next Sunday, June 5th. So it's every Sunday in June and July at 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not meeting the Sunday, July 3rd. We're going to take a little break mm-hmm. to celebrate our country.
What are some of the highlights of the lineup?
So yeah, in previous years we've really focused on classic films, but this year we're kind of trying to bounce back and forth between them. And yet again, like I said earlier, kind of show those thematic links from how a movie in the late 1930s can still sort of have the same theme as a movie from, you know, 2012. So mm-hmm. we got Imitation of Life is coming up on our schedule. We have Selma, 12 Years a Slave. The Wiz is coming up. there's 8 movies total, and yeah, they all kind of, we kind of try to go back and forth each week. So 1 week's a classic, 1 week is a modern film, because mm-hmm. yet again, that's another thing that members of the public told us they wanted to see. Is
when you say classic, like at this point, is The Wiz a classic?
Yeah.
Or will it ever be? Just check.
Maybe that was a little bit of a haughty term, but
No, I'm just, yeah, just easing on down the road here.
I got some new popularity with the NBC.
I know, with that live thing they did.
So taking it back to the OG, the original.
Yeah, right.
With, Diana Ross and Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. Also, not Ben Vereen. I'm trying to think of, I don't think it's Ben Vereen. He played the Scarecrow, anybody know? Putting the pressure on there. It'll come to me in a second. But no, kind of an all-star cast for that time for sure. Let's see. So that's going on, mm-hmm. and then but that's far from all you guys have going on. There's an ever unfolding series of concerts.
Yes, there's concerts.
I saw Evelyn Champagne King is coming. Is that right?
I believe so. There's so many concerts that come in. Shell is coming in with, which is another really popular group for the UK crowd. That's going to be on Woodsongs. We also have, and we kind of alluded to our youth programming. We start that actually the Saturday before the film series, which Tim has been running that for several years as well.
So what does that look like? You've got youth programming. You go through the summer or all year round, or
we have this one is our summer, which is the longest running part. But you know, that's kind of the model. And then the spring program, we just had our spring break program, and then we're looking at building out fall youth programming mm-hmm. as well.
And so, I mean, I'm thinking during the summer, this is a great way to help kids have something to do and stay out of trouble.
Always. Yeah, I mean, it's all creative arts education for spring break and summer. And this year, we're pretty thrilled with the lineup, with an intro to guitar class, which I've been fighting for a couple of years. And we finally made it happen, thanks to a lot of guitars from Doo Wop Shop. And then creative writing and intro to dance.
Okay. And so intro to dance, intro, did you say intro to guitar?
Intro to guitar, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then creative writing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So these are like, there's movement involved, there's music involved. Mm-hmm. Somehow I feel like you planned it this way.
No.
There's visual art involved. And it also a great use for that amazing space there, and the variety of space there is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe the dancers and the musicians get to play on that wonderful lyric stage at some point.
Yeah, we're definitely hoping for that. Trying to tie it all together in the end, but for now I'll just teach them the basics.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So we've just got a couple more minutes, but what else is on the horizon for the Lyric has over the last, you know, we talked about this. It's been open for 5 years now. Mm-hmm. Is that right? That reopened mm-hmm. for 5 years.
Yes.
And is coming into, I think it's still coming into its own in a lot of ways.
Yeah. We have as a,
you've been the director for
just over a year.
Yeah.
And so there was some great things that, you know, I came into and inherited and was able to continue and support. And we want to be able to constantly expand and evolve and listen to the community, what they need, satisfy our mission, and continue to move. I mean, I want to see this building persist way beyond my tenure here, you know, regardless if it's 50 years. I want to be able to see.
You better, because they ain't rebuilding it again, okay? No.
But we have, so I have this big dream in our 15th year anniversary, which would match the longest that the building has been open. At midnight, we're going to throw a bunch of balloons and whatnot. So it's 9 years in advance, but everybody's invited. You know, mark your calendar, 16 years from now. You know, things that are part of what our core is just trying to make sure the community is aware of what we have going on. We have an assortment of, you know, accessibilities from the financial standpoint. You know, sometimes you pay this, not paying that. And we don't want to create barriers. We also want to be able to find ways to do our part, be stewards of the East End, hopefully encourage development for the East End, because East End is this prime potential that needs to be curated in a certain way so it doesn't offend the current neighborhood, but it also progresses the neighborhood in a positive direction as we move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so once that starts to happen, it's already happening at the Midland corridor. Hopefully it'll come over through us. We have the Legacy Trail as well that is building up the neighborhood. And we're just blessed to be in the position that we're in, to be ahead of the game, people coming into us, people looking at us to see that we're doing great things, and hopefully more great things will come to the neighborhood.
Absolutely. Well, I know that I'm thrilled to have the Lyric Theater downtown and such a just kind of important location. You know, it's not among big business buildings. It's among houses. It's among venerable neighborhoods. It's absolutely right in the middle of where people live and have lived and will continue to live. And I just think the Lyric is such an incredible resource. So I look forward to seeing what you guys have coming up, and keep coming back and visiting, and we'll spread the word. How's that sound?
Yeah, and if you want some more information, you can do yourself a favor. Go to lexandlyric.com.